short trial that he can get enough work out of a boy without putting too much food into him, he shall have him for a term of years to do what he likes with. When little Oliver was taken before the gentleman that evening, and informed that he was to go that night as general house lad to a coffin maker's, and that if he complained of his situation or ever came back to the parish again, he would be sent to sea, there to be drowned or knocked on the head, as the case might be, he evinced so little emotion that they by common consent pronounced him a hardened young rascal, and ordered Mr. Bumble to remove him forthwith. Now, although it was very natural that the board, of all people in the world, should feel in a great state of virtuous astonishment and horror at the smallest tokens of want of feeling on the part of anybody, they were rather out in this particular instance. The simple fact was that Oliver, instead of possessing too little feeling, possessed rather too much, and was in a fair way of being reduced for life to a state of brutal stupidity and sullenness, by the ill usage he had received. He heard the news of his destination in perfect silence, and, having had his luggage put into his hand, which was not very difficult to carry, inasmuch as it was all comprised within the limits of a brown paper parcel, about half a foot square by 3 inches deep, he pulled his cap over his eyes, and once more attaching himself to Mr. Bumble's coat cuff, was led away by that dignitary to a new scene of suffering. For some time Mr. Bumble drew Oliver along without notice or remark, for the beadle carried his head very erect, as a beadle always should, and, it being a windy day, little Oliver was completely enshrouded by the skirts of Mr. Bumble's coat as they blew open, and disclosed to great advantage his flapped waistcoat and drab plush knee-breeches. As they drew near to their destination, however, Mr. Bumble thought it expedient to look down and see that the boy was in good order for inspection by his new master, which he accordingly did, with a fit and becoming air of gracious patronage.
"Oliver," said Mr. Bumble.
"Yes, sir," replied Oliver in a low, tremulous voice.
"Pull that cap off your eyes and hold up your head, sir."
Although Oliver did as he was desired at once, and passed the back of his unoccupied hand briskly across his eyes, he left a tear in them when he looked up at his conductor. As Mr. Bumble gazed sternly upon him, it rolled down his cheek. It was followed by another, and another. The child made a strong effort, but it was an unsuccessful one. Withdrawing his other hand from Mr. Bumble's, he covered his face with both, and wept until the tears sprung out from between his thin and bony fingers.
"Well," exclaimed Mr. Bumble, stopping short and darting at his little charge a look of intense malignity, "well, of all the ungratefullest and worst-disposed boys as ever I see, Oliver, you are the—"
"No, no, sir,"
sobbed Oliver, clinging to the hand which held the well-known cane.
"No, no, sir. I will be good indeed. Indeed, indeed I will, sir. I am a very little boy, sir, and it is so—"
"So what?"
inquired Mr. Bumble in amazement.
"So lonely, sir, so very lonely," cried the child. "Everybody hates me. Oh, sir, don't pray be cross to me."
The child beat his hand upon his heart, and looked in his companion's face with tears of real agony. Mr. Bumble regarded Oliver's piteous and helpless look with some astonishment for a few seconds, hemmed 3 or 4 times in a husky manner, and, after muttering something about "that troublesome cough," bade Oliver dry his eyes and be a good boy, and, once more taking his hand, he walked on with him in silence. The undertaker, who had just put up the shutters of his shop, was making some entries in his day-book by the light of a most appropriately dismal candle, when Mr. Bumble entered.
"Ah,"
said the undertaker, looking up from the book, and pausing in the middle of a word, "is that you, Bumble?"
"No one else, Mr. Sowerberry," replied the beadle. "Here, I brought the boy."
Oliver made a bow.
"Oh, that's the boy, is it?"
said the undertaker, raising the candle above his head to get a better view of Oliver.
"Mrs. Sowerberry, will you have the goodness to come here a moment, my dear?"
Mrs. Sowerberry emerged from a little room behind the shop, and presented the form of a short, thin, squeezed-up woman with a vixenish countenance.
"My dear," said Mr. Sowerberry deferentially, "this is the boy from the workhouse that I told you of."
Oliver bowed again.
"Dear me," said the undertaker's wife, "he's very small."
"Why, he is rather small,"
replied Mr. Bumble, looking at Oliver as if it were his fault that he was no bigger.
"He is small, there's no denying it. But he'll grow, Mrs. Sowerberry, he'll grow."
"Ah, I dare say he will," replied the lady pettishly, "on our victuals and our drink. I see no saving in parish children, not I, for they always cost more to keep than they're worth. However, men always think they know best. There, get downstairs, little vagabonds."
With this, the undertaker's wife opened a side door and pushed Oliver down a steep flight of stairs into a stone cell, damp and dark, forming the anteroom of the coal cellar, and denominated kitchen, wherein sat a slatternly girl, in shoes down at heel and blue worsted stockings, very much out of repair.
"Here, Charlotte," said Mrs. Sowerberry, who had followed Oliver down, "give this boy some of the cold bits that were put by for Trip. He hasn't come home since the morning, so he may go without them. I dare say the boy isn't too dainty to eat them. Are you, boy?"
Oliver, whose eyes had glistened at the mention of meat, and who was trembling with eagerness to devour it, replied in the negative, and a plateful of coarse broken victuals was set before him. I wish some well-fed philosopher, whose meat and drink turn to gall within him, whose blood is ice, whose heart is iron, could have seen Oliver Twist clutching at the dainty viands that the dog had neglected. I wish he could have witnessed the horrible avidity with which Oliver tore the bits asunder with all the ferocity of famine. There is only one thing I should like better, and that would be to see the philosopher making the same sort of meal himself, with the same relish.
"Well," said the undertaker's wife, when Oliver had finished his supper, which she had regarded in silent horror and with fearful auguries of his future appetite, "have you done?"
There being nothing eatable within his reach, Oliver replied in the affirmative.
"Then come with me," said Mrs. Sowerberry, taking up a dim and dirty lamp and leading the way upstairs. "Your bed's under the counter. You don't mind sleeping among the coffins, I suppose. But it doesn't much matter whether you do or don't, for you can't sleep anywhere else. Come, don't keep me here all night."
Oliver lingered no longer, but meekly followed his new mistress. End of side one. Side two, chapter five. Oliver mingles with new associates. Going to a funeral for the first time, he forms an unfavourable notion of his master's business. Oliver, being left to himself in the undertaker's shop, set the lamp down on a workman's bench and gazed timidly about him with a feeling of awe and dread, which many people a good deal older than he will be at no loss to understand. An unfinished coffin on black trestles, which stood in the middle of the shop, looked so gloomy and deathlike that a cold tremble came over him every time his eyes wandered in the direction of the dismal object, from which he almost expected to see some frightful form slowly rear its head to drive him mad with terror. Against the wall were ranged in regular array a long row of elm boards cut into the same shape, looking in the dim light like high-shouldered ghosts with their hands in their breeches pockets. Coffin plates, elm chips, bright-headed nails, and shreds of black cloth lay scattered on the floor, and the wall behind the counter was ornamented with a lively representation of two mutes in very stiff neckcloths, on duty at a large private door, with a hearse drawn by four black steeds approaching in the distance. The shop was close and hot. The atmosphere seemed tainted with the smell of coffins. The recess beneath the counter in which his flock mattress was thrust looked like a grave. Nor were these the only dismal feelings which depressed Oliver. He was alone in a strange place, and we all know how chilled and desolate the best of us will sometimes feel in such a situation. The boy had no friends to care for, or to care for him. The regret of no recent separation was fresh in his mind. The absence of no loved and well-remembered face sank heavily into his heart. But his heart was heavy, notwithstanding, and he wished, as he crept into his narrow bed, that were his coffin, and that he could be lain in a calm and lasting sleep in the churchyard ground, with the tall grass waving gently above his head,
and the sound of the old deep bell to soothe him in his sleep. Oliver was awakened in the morning by a loud kicking at the outside of the shop door, which, before he could huddle on his clothes, was repeated in an angry and impetuous manner about 25 times. When he began to undo the chain, the legs desisted, and a voice began.
"Open the door, will you?"
cried the voice, which belonged to the legs which had kicked at the door.
"I will, directly, sir,"
replied Oliver, undoing the chain and turning the key.
"I suppose you're the new boy, ain't you?"
said the voice through the keyhole.
"Yes, sir,"
replied Oliver.
"How old are you?"
inquired the voice.
10, sir,"
replied Oliver.
"Then I'll whop you when I get in," said the voice. "You just see if I don't, that's all, my workus brat."
And having made this obliging promise, the voice began to whistle. Oliver had been too often subjected to the process to which the very expressive monosyllable just recorded bears reference to entertain the smallest doubt that the owner of the voice, whoever he might be, would redeem his pledge most honourably. He drew back the bolts with a trembling hand and opened the door. For a second or two, Oliver glanced up the street and down the street and over the way, impressed with the belief that the unknown who had addressed him through the keyhole had walked a few paces off to warm himself. For nobody did he see but a big charity boy sitting on a post in front of the house eating a slice of bread and butter, which he cut into wedges the size of his mouth with a clasp knife and then consumed with great dexterity.
"I beg your pardon, sir,"
said Oliver at length, seeing that no other visitor made his appearance.
"Did you knock?"
"I kicked,"
replied the charity boy.
"Did you want a coffin, sir?"
inquired Oliver innocently. At this, the charity boy looked monstrous fierce and said that Oliver would stand in need of one before long if he cut jokes with his superiors in that way.
"You don't know who I am, I suppose, workus,"
said the charity boy, in continuation, descending from the top of the post meanwhile with edifying gravity.
"No, sir,"
rejoined Oliver.
"I'm Mr. Noah Claypole," said the charity boy, "and you're under me. Take down the shutters, you idle young ruffian."
With this, Mr. Claypole administered a kick to Oliver and entered the shop with a dignified air which did him great credit. It is difficult for a large-headed, small-eyed youth of lumbering make and heavy countenance to look dignified under any circumstances, but it is more especially so when superadded to these personal attractions are a red nose and yellow smalls. Oliver, having taken down the shutters and broken a pane of glass in his efforts to stagger away beneath the weight of the first one to a small court at the side of the house in which they were kept during the day, was graciously assisted by Noah, who, having consoled him with the assurance that he'd catch it, condescended to help him. Mr. Sowerberry came down soon after. Shortly afterwards, Mrs. Sowerberry appeared. Oliver, having caught it in fulfilment of Noah's prediction, followed that young gentleman down the stairs to breakfast.
"Come near the fire, Noah," said Charlotte. "I saved a nice little bit of bacon for you from Master's breakfast. Oliver, shut that door at Mr. Noah's back and take them bits that I've put out on the cover of the bread pan. There's your tea. Take it away to that box and drink it there, and make haste, for they'll want you to mind the shop. D'ye hear?"
"Do you hear, workus?" said Noah Claypole.
"Lor, Noah," said Charlotte, "what a rum creature you are. Why don't you let the boy alone?"
"Let him alone," said Noah. "Why, everybody lets him alone enough, for the matter of that. Neither his father nor his mother will ever interfere with him. All his relations let him have his own way pretty well. Eh, Charlotte?"
"Oh, you queer soul,"
said Charlotte, bursting into a hearty laugh, in which she was joined by Noah, after which they both looked scornfully at poor Oliver Twist, as he sat shivering on the box in the coldest corner of the room, and ate the stale pieces which had been specially reserved for him. Noah was a charity boy, but not a workhouse orphan. No chance child was he, for he could trace his genealogy all the way back to his parents, who lived hard by, his mother being a washerwoman, and his father a drunken soldier discharged with a wooden leg and a diurnal pension of tuppence halfpenny and an unstateable fraction. The shop boys in the neighbourhood had long been in the habit of branding Noah in the public streets with the ignominious epithets of Leathers, Charity, and the like, and Noah had borne them without reply. But now that fortune had cast in his way a nameless orphan, at whom even the meanest could point the finger of scorn, he retorted on him with interest. This affords charming food for contemplation. It shows us what a beautiful thing human nature may be made to be, and how impartially the same amiable qualities are developed in the finest lord and the dirtiest charity boy. Oliver had been sojourning at the undertaker's some 3 weeks or a month. Mr. and Mrs. Sowerberry, the shop being shut up, were taking their supper in the little back parlour, when Mr. Sowerberry, after several deferential glances at his wife, said, "My dear." He was going to say more, but Mrs. Sowerberry looking up with a peculiarly unpropitious aspect, he stopped short. "Well," said Mrs. Sowerberry sharply.
"Nothing, my dear, nothing," said Mr. Sowerberry.
"Oh, you brute,"
said Mrs. Sowerberry.
"Not at all, my dear," said Mr. Sowerberry humbly. "I thought you didn't want to hear, my dear. I was only going to say..."
"Oh, don't tell me what you were going to say," interposed Mrs. Sowerberry. "I'm nobody. Don't consult me, pray. I don't want to intrude upon your secrets."
As Mrs. Sowerberry said this, she gave an hysterical laugh which threatened violent consequences.
"But, my dear," said Sowerberry, "I want to ask your advice."
"No, no, don't ask mine,"
replied Mrs. Sowerberry in an affecting manner.
"Ask somebody else's."
Here there was another hysterical laugh, which frightened Mr. Sowerberry very much. This is a very common and much approved matrimonial course of treatment, which is often very effective. It at once reduced Mr. Sowerberry to begging, as a special favour, to be allowed to say what Mrs. Sowerberry was most curious to hear. After a short altercation of less than 3/4 of an hour's duration, the permission was most graciously conceded.
"It's only about young Twist, my dear," said Mr. Sowerberry. "A very good-looking boy, that, my dear."
"He need be, for he eats enough," observed the lady.
"There's an expression of melancholy in his face, my dear,"
resumed Mr. Sowerberry,
"which is very interesting. He would make a delightful mute, my love."
Mrs. Sowerberry looked up with an expression of considerable wonderment. Mr. Sowerberry remarked it, and without allowing time for any observation on the good lady's part, proceeded.
"I don't mean a regular mute to attend grown-up people, my dear. But only for children's practice. It would be very new to have a mute in proportion, my dear. You may depend upon it, it would have a superb effect."
Mrs. Sowerberry, who had a good deal of taste in the undertaking way, was much struck by the novelty of this idea. But as it would have been compromising her dignity to have said so under existing circumstances, she merely inquired with much sharpness why such an obvious suggestion had not presented itself to her husband's mind before. Mr. Sowerberry rightly construed this as an acquiescence in his proposition. It was speedily determined, therefore, that Oliver should be at once initiated into the mysteries of the profession, and, with this view, that he should accompany his master on the very next occasion of his services being required. The occasion was not long in coming. 30 minutes after breakfast next morning, Mr. Bumble entered the shop, and, supporting his cane against the counter, drew forth his large leathern pocket-book, from which he selected a small scrap of paper, which he handed over to Sowerberry.
"Aha,"
said the undertaker, glancing over it with a lively countenance.
"An order for a coffin, eh?"
"Yeah, for a coffin first, and a parochial funeral afterwards,"
replied Mr. Bumble, fastening the strap of the leathern pocket-book, which, like himself, was very corpulent.
"Baton,"
said the undertaker, looking from the scrap of paper to Mr. Bumble.
"I never heard the name before."
Bumble shook his head as he replied,
"Obstinate people, Mr. Sowerberry, very obstinate. Proud, too, I'm afraid, sir."
"Proud, eh?" exclaimed Mr. Sowerberry with a sneer. "Come, that's too much."
"Oh, it's sickening," replied the beadle. "Antimonial, Mr. Sowerberry."
"So it is,"
acquiesced the undertaker.
"'We only heard of the family the night before last,' said the beadle, "'and we shouldn't have known anything about them then. "'Only a woman who lodges in the same house "'made an application to the parochial committee "'for them to send the parochial surgeon "'to see a woman as was very bad. "'He had gone out to dinner, "'but his prentice, which is a very clever lad, "'sent him some medicine in a blacking bottle, off-hand.
"'Ah, there's promptness,' said the undertaker.
"'Promptness, indeed,' replied the beadle. "'But what's the consequence? "'What's the ungrateful behaviour of these rebels, sir? "'Why, the husband sends back word "'that the medicine won't suit his wife's complaint, "'and so she shan't take it. "'Says she shan't take it, sir. "'Good, strong, wholesome medicine, "'as was given with great success "'to two Irish labourers and a coal heaver "'only a week before. "'Sent him for nothing with a blacking bottle in. "'And he sends back word that she shan't take it, sir.'
As the flagrant atrocity presented itself to Mr. Bumble's mind in full force, he struck the counter sharply with his cane, and became flushed with indignation.
"Well," said the undertaker, "I never did."
"Never did, sir,"
ejaculated the beadle.
"No, nor nobody never did. But now she's dead, we've got to bury her. And that's the direction, and the sooner it's done, the better."
Thus saying, Mr. Bumble put on his cocked hat, wrong side first, in a fever of parochial excitement, and flounced out of the shop.
"Why, he was so angry, Oliver, that he forgot even to ask after you," said Mr. Sowerberry, looking after the beadle as he strode down the street.
"Yes, sir,"
replied Oliver, who had carefully kept himself out of sight during the interview, and who was shaking from head to foot at the mere recollection of the sound of Mr. Bumble's voice. He needn't have taken the trouble to shrink from Mr. Bumble's glance, however, for that functionary on whom the prediction of the gentleman in the white waistcoat had made a very strong impression thought that now the undertaker had got Oliver upon trial, the subject was better avoided until such time as he should be firmly bound for 7 years, and all danger of his being returned upon the hands of the parish should be thus effectually and legally overcome. "Well," said Mr. Sowerberry, taking up his hat, "the sooner this job is done, the better. Noah, look after the shop. Oliver, put on your cap and come with me." Oliver obeyed and followed his master on his professional mission. They walked on for some time through the most crowded and densely inhabited part of the town, and then, striking down a narrow street more dirty and miserable than any they had yet passed through, paused to look for the house which was the object of their search. The houses on either side were high and large, but very old, and tenanted by people of the poorest class, as their neglected appearance would have sufficiently denoted, without the concurrent testimony afforded by the squalid looks of the few men and women who, with folded arms and bodies half doubled, occasionally skulked along. A great many of the tenements had shop fronts, but they were fast closed and mouldering away, only the upper rooms being inhabited. Some houses, which had become insecure from age and decay, were prevented from falling into the street by huge beams of wood reared against the walls and firmly planted in the road. But even these crazy dens seemed to have been selected as the nightly haunts of some houseless wretches, for many of the rough boards which supplied the place of door and window were wrenched from their positions to afford an aperture wide enough for the passage of a human body. The kennel was stagnant and filthy. The very rats, which here and there lay putrefying in its rottenness, were hideous with famine. There was neither knocker nor bell-handle at the open door where Oliver and his master stopped. So, groping his way cautiously through the dark passage and bidding Oliver keep close to him and not be afraid, the undertaker mounted to the top of the first flight of stairs. Stumbling against a door on the landing, he rapped at it with his knuckles. It was opened by a young girl of 13 or 14. The undertaker at once saw enough of what the room contained to know it was the apartment to which he had been directed. He stepped in. Oliver followed him. There was no fire in the room, but a man was crouching mechanically over the empty stove. An old woman, too, had drawn a low stool to the cold hearth and was sitting beside him. There were some ragged children in another corner, and in a small recess opposite the door there lay upon the ground something covered with an old blanket. Oliver shuddered as he cast his eyes towards the place,
and crept involuntarily closer to his master, for though it was covered up, the boy felt that it was a corpse. The man's face was thin and very pale. His hair and beard were grisly. His eyes were bloodshot. The old woman's face was wrinkled. Her two remaining teeth protruded over her underlip, and her eyes were bright and piercing. Oliver was afraid to look at either her or the man. They seemed so like the rats he had seen outside.
"Nobody shall go near her,"
said the man, starting fiercely up as the undertaker approached the recess.
"Keep back! Damn you, keep back if you've a life to lose!"
"Nonsense, my good man," said the undertaker, who was pretty well used to misery in all its shapes. "Nonsense!"
"I tell you,"
said the man, clenching his hands and stamping furiously on the floor,
"I tell you I won't have her put into the ground. She couldn't rest there. The worms would worry her, not eat her, she is so worn away."
The undertaker offered no reply to this raving, but, producing a tape from his pocket, knelt down for a moment by the side of the body.
"Ah,"
said the man, bursting into tears and sinking on his knees at the feet of the dead woman.
"Kneel down, kneel down, kneel round her, every one of you, and mark my words. I say she was starved to death. I never knew how bad she was till a fever came upon her, and then her bones were starting through the skin. There was neither fire nor candle. She died in the dark, in the dark. She couldn't even see her children's faces, though we heard her gasping out their names. I begged for her in the streets, and they sent me to prison. When I came back, she was dying, and all the blood in my heart has dried up, for they starved her to death. I swear it before the God that saw it. They starved her!"
He twined his hands in his hair, and with a loud scream rolled grovelling upon the floor, his eyes fixed, and the foam covering his lips. The terrified children cried bitterly. But the old woman, who had hitherto remained as quiet as if she had been wholly deaf to all that passed, menaced them into silence. Having unloosed the cravat of the man who still remained extended on the ground, she tottered towards the undertaker.
"She was my daughter,"
said the old woman, nodding her head in the direction of the corpse, and speaking with an idiotic leer, more ghastly than even the presence of death in such a place.
"Lord, Lord, well, it is strange that I, who gave birth to her and was a woman then, should be alive and merry now, and she lying there so cold and stiff. Lord, Lord, to think of it! It's as good as a play, as good as a play."
As the wretched creature mumbled and chuckled in her hideous merriment, the undertaker turned to go away.
"Stop! Stop!"
said the old woman in a loud whisper.
"Will she be buried tomorrow, or next day, or tonight? I laid her out, and I must walk, you know. Send me a large cloak, a good warm one, for it is bitter cold. We should have cake and wine, too, before we go. Never mind, send some bread. Only a loaf of bread and a cup of water. Shall we have some bread, dear?"
she said eagerly, catching at the undertaker's coat as he once more moved towards the door.
"Yes, yes," said the undertaker, "of course. Anything you like."
He disengaged himself from the old woman's grasp, and, drawing Oliver after him, hurried away. The next day, the family having been meanwhile relieved with a half-quartern loaf and a piece of cheese left with them by Mr. Bumble himself, Oliver and his master returned to the miserable abode, where Mr. Bumble had already arrived, accompanied by four men from the workhouse who were to act as bearers. An old black cloak had been thrown over the rags of the old woman and the man, and the bare coffin, having been screwed down, was hoisted onto the shoulders of the bearers and carried into the street.
"Now, you must put your best leg foremost, old lady," whispered Sowerberry in the old woman's ear. "We're rather late, and it won't do to keep the clergyman waiting. Move on, my men, as quick as you like."
Thus directed, the bearers trotted on under their light burden, and the two mourners kept as near them as they could. Mr. Bumble and Sowerberry walked at a good smart pace in front, and Oliver, whose legs were not so long as his master's, ran by the side. There was not so great a necessity for hurrying as Mr. Sowerberry had anticipated, however, for when they reached the obscure corner of the churchyard in which the nettles grew, and where the parish graves were made. The clergyman had not arrived, and the clerk, who was sitting by the vestry room fire, seemed to think it by no means improbable that it might be an hour or so before he came. So they put the bier on the brink of the grave, and the two mourners waited patiently in the damp clay, with a cold rain drizzling down, while the ragged boys, whom the spectacle had attracted into the churchyard, played a noisy game at hide-and-seek among the tombstones, or varied their amusements by jumping backwards and forwards over the coffin. Mr. Sowerberry and Bumble, being personal friends of the clerk, sat by the fire with him and read the paper. At length, after a lapse of something more than an hour, Mr. Bumble and Sowerberry and the clerk were seen running towards the grave. Immediately afterwards the clergyman appeared, putting on his surplice as he came along. Mr. Bumble then thrashed a boy or two to keep up appearances, and the reverend gentleman, having read as much of the burial service as could be compressed into 4 minutes, gave his surplice to the clerk and walked away again. "Now, Bill," said Sowerberry to the gravedigger, "fill up." It was no very difficult task, for the grave was so full that the uppermost coffin was within a few feet of the surface. The gravedigger shovelled in the earth, stamped it loosely down with his feet, shouldered his spade, and walked off, followed by the boys, who murmured very loud complaints at the fun being over so soon.
"Come, my good fellow,"
said Bumble, tapping the man on the back.
"They want to shut up the yard."
The man, who had never once moved since he had taken his station by the graveside, started, raised his head, stared at the person who had addressed him, walked forward for a few paces, and fell down in a swoon. The crazy old woman was too much occupied in bewailing the loss of her cloak, which the undertaker had taken off, to pay him any attention. So they threw a can of cold water over him, and when he came to, saw him safely out of the churchyard, locked the gate, and departed on their different ways. "Well, Oliver," said Sowerberry, as they walked home, "how do you like it?"
"Pretty well, thank you, sir," replied Oliver, with considerable hesitation. "Not very much, sir."
"Ah, you'll get used to it in time, Oliver," said Sowerberry. "Nothing when you are used to it, my boy."
Oliver wondered in his own mind whether it had taken a very long time to get Mr. Sowerberry used to it. But he thought it better not to ask the question, and walked back to the shop, thinking over all he had seen and heard. Chapter 6. Oliver, being goaded by the taunts of Noah, rouses into action and rather astonishes him. The month's trial over, Oliver was formally apprenticed. It was a nice sickly season just at this time. In commercial phrase, coffins were looking up. And in the course of a few weeks, Oliver acquired a great deal of experience. The success of Mr. Sowerberry's ingenious speculation exceeded even his most sanguine hopes. The oldest inhabitants recollected no period at which measles had been so prevalent or so fatal to infant existence, and many were the mournful processions which little Oliver headed, in a hatband reaching down to his knees, to the indescribable admiration and emotion of all the mothers in the town. As Oliver accompanied his master in most of his adult expeditions too, in order that he might acquire that equanimity of demeanour and full command of nerve which are so essential to a finished undertaker, he had many opportunities of observing the beautiful resignation and fortitude with which some strong-minded people bear their trials and losses. For instance, when Sowerberry had an order for the burial of some rich old lady or gentleman, who was surrounded by a great number of nephews and nieces, who had been perfectly inconsolable during the previous illness, and whose grief had been wholly irrepressible even on the most public occasions, they would be as happy among themselves as need be, quite cheerful and contented, conversing together with as much freedom and gaiety as if nothing whatever had happened to disturb them. Husbands, too, bore the loss of their wives with the most heroic calmness. Wives, again, put on weeds for their husbands, as if, so far from grieving in the garb of sorrow, they had made up their minds to render it as becoming and attractive as possible.
It was observable, too, that ladies and gentlemen who were in passions of anguish during the ceremony of interment recovered almost as soon as they reached home and became quite composed before the tea-drinking was over. All this was very pleasant and improving to see, and Oliver beheld it with great admiration. That Oliver Twist was moved to resignation by the example of these good people, I cannot, although I am his biographer, undertake to affirm with any degree of confidence. But I can most distinctly say that for many months he continued meekly to submit to the domination and ill-treatment of Noah Claypole, who used him far worse than before, now that his jealousy was roused by seeing the new boy promoted to the black stick and hatband, while he, the old one, remained stationary in the muffin cap and leathers. Charlotte treated him ill because Noah did, and Mrs. Sowerberry was his decided enemy because Mr. Sowerberry was disposed to be his friend. So between these three on one side and a glut of funerals on the other, Oliver was not altogether as comfortable as the hungry pig was when he was shut up, by mistake, in the grain department of a brewery. And now I come to a very important passage in Oliver's history. For I have to record an act, slight and unimportant perhaps in appearance, but which indirectly produced a material change in all his future prospects and proceedings. One day, Oliver and Noah had descended into the kitchen at the usual dinner hour to banquet upon a small joint of mutton, a pound and a half of the worst end of the neck, when, Charlotte being called out of the way, there ensued a brief interval of time which Noah Claypole, being hungry and vicious, considered he could not possibly devote to a worthier purpose than aggravating and tantalizing young Oliver Twist. Intent upon this innocent amusement, Noah put his feet on the tablecloth and pulled Oliver's hair, and twitched his ears, and expressed his opinion that he was a sneak, and furthermore announced his intention of coming to see him hanged, whenever that desirable event should take place, and entered upon various other topics of petty annoyance, like a malicious and ill-conditioned charity boy as he was. But none of these taunts producing the desired effect of making Oliver cry, Noah attempted to be more facetious still, and in this attempt did what many small wits with far greater reputations than Noah sometimes do to this day when they want to be funny. He got rather personal.
"Workus," said Noah, "how's your mother?"
"She's dead," replied Oliver. "Don't you say anything about her to me." Oliver's colour rose as he said this. He breathed quickly, and there was a curious working of the mouth and nostrils, which Mr. Claypole thought must be the immediate precursor of a violent fit of crying. Under this impression, he returned to the charge.
"What did she die of, Workus?" said Noah.
"Of a broken heart, some of our old nurses told me," replied Oliver, more as if he were talking to himself than answering Noah. "I think I know what it must be to die of that."
"Told it all right for Larry, Workus," said Noah, as a tear rolled down Oliver's cheek. "What sent you a snivelly now?"
"Not you," replied Oliver, hastily brushing the tear away. "Don't think it."
"Oh, not me, eh?" sneered Noah.
"No, not you," replied Oliver sharply. "There, that's enough. Don't say anything more to me about her. You better not."
"Better not," exclaimed Noah. "Well, better not. Workus, don't be impudent. Your mother, too. She was a nice one, she was. Oh, no."
And here Noah nodded his head expressively and curled up as much of his small red nose as muscular action could collect together for the occasion.
"You know, Workus," continued Noah, emboldened by Oliver's silence, and speaking in a jeering tone of affected pity, of all tones the most annoying, "you know, Workus, it can't be helped now, and of course you couldn't help it then, and I'm very sorry for it, and I'm sure we all are, and pity you very much. But you must know, Workus, your mother was a regular right-down bad un."
"What did you say?" inquired Oliver, looking up very quickly.
"A regular right-down bad un, Workus," replied Noah coolly. "And it's a great deal better, Workus, that she died when she did, or else she'd have been hard labouring in Bridewell, or transported, or hung, which is more likely than either, isn't it?
Crimson with fury, Oliver started up, overthrew the chair and table, seized Noah by the throat, shook him in the violence of his rage till his teeth chattered in his head, and collecting his whole force into one heavy blow, felled him to the ground. A minute ago, the boy had looked the quiet, mild, dejected creature that harsh treatment had made him. But his spirit was roused at last. The cruel insult to his dead mother had set his blood on fire. His breast heaved, his attitude was erect, his eye bright and vivid, his whole person changed as he stood glaring over the cowardly tormentor who now lay crouching at his feet and defied him with an energy he had never known before.
"He'll murder me!"
blubbered Noah.
"Charlotte, missus, is the new boy a murdering of me? Help! Help! Oliver's gone mad! Charlotte!"
Noah's shouts were responded to by a loud scream from Charlotte and a louder from Mrs. Sowerberry, the former of whom rushed into the kitchen by a side door, while the latter paused on the staircase till she was quite certain that it was consistent with the preservation of human life to come farther down.
"Oh, you little wretch!" screamed Charlotte, seizing Oliver with her utmost force, which was about equal to that of a moderately strong man in particularly good training. "Oh, you little ungrateful, murderous, horrid villain!"
And between every syllable, Charlotte gave Oliver a blow with all her might, accompanying it with a scream for the benefit of society. Charlotte's fist was by no means a light one. But lest it should not be effectual in calming Oliver's wrath, Mrs. Sowerberry plunged into the kitchen and assisted to hold him with one hand while she scratched his face with the other. In this favourable position of affairs, Noah rose from the ground and pummeled him behind. This was rather too violent exercise to last long. When they were all wearied out and could tear and beat no longer, they dragged Oliver, struggling and shouting, but nothing daunted, into the dust cellar, and there locked him up. This being done, Mrs. Sowerberry sunk into a chair and burst into tears.
"Bless her, she's going off," said Charlotte. "A glass of water, Noah, dear, make haste." "Oh, Charlotte," said Mrs. Sowerberry,
speaking as well as she could through a deficiency of breath and a sufficiency of cold water, which Noah had poured over her head and shoulders.
"Oh, oh, Charlotte, what a mercy we have not all been murdered in our beds."
"Ah, mercy indeed, ma'am," was the reply.
"I only hope this'll teach master not to have any more of these dreadful creatures that are born to be murderers and robbers from their very cradle. Poor Noah, he was all but killed, mum, when I come in." "Poor fellow," said Mrs. Sowerberry, looking piteously on the charity boy.
Noah, whose top waistcoat button might have been somewhere on a level with the crown of Oliver's head, rubbed his eyes with the inside of his wrists while this commiseration was bestowed upon him, and performed some affecting tears and sniffs.
"What's to be done?" exclaimed Mrs. Sowerberry. "Your master's not at home. There's not a man in the house, and he'll kick that door down in 10 minutes.
Oliver's vigorous plunges against the bit of timber in question rendered this occurrence highly probable.
"Dear, dear, I don't know, ma'am," said Charlotte, "unless we send for the police officers."
"Or the millingtory,"
suggested Mr. Claypole.
No,
said Mrs. Sowerberry, bethinking herself of Oliver's old friend.
"Run to Mr. Bumble, Noah, and tell him to come here directly, and not to lose a minute. Never mind your cap. Make haste. You can hold a knife to that black eye as you run along. It'll keep the swelling down."
Noah stopped to make no reply, but started off at his fullest speed. And very much it astonished the people who were out walking to see a charity boy tearing through the streets pell-mell with no cap on his head and a clasp knife at his eye. Chapter 7. Oliver continues refractory. Noah Claypole ran along the streets at his swiftest pace and paused not once for breath until he reached the workhouse gate. Having rested here for a minute or so to collect a good burst of sobs and an imposing show of tears and terror, he knocked loudly at the wicket, and presented such a rueful face to the aged pauper who opened it, that even he, who saw nothing but rueful faces about him at the best of times, started back in astonishment.
"Why, what's the matter with the boy?" said the old pauper.
"Mr. Bumble! Mr. Bumble!" cried Noah, with well-affected dismay, and in tones so loud and agitated that they not only caught the ear of Mr. Bumble himself, who happened to be hard by, but alarmed him so much that he rushed into the yard without his cocked hat, which is a very curious and remarkable circumstance, as showing that even a beadle, acted upon by a sudden and powerful impulse, may be afflicted with a momentary visitation of loss of self-possession and forgetfulness of personal dignity.
"Oh, Mr. Bumble, sir," said Noah. Oliver is...
"What? What?"
interposed Mr. Bumble with a gleam of pleasure in his metallic eyes.
"Not run away. He hasn't run away, has he, Noah?"
"No, sir, no. Not run away, sir. But he's turned vicious,"
replied Noah.
"He tried to murder me, sir, and then he tried to murder Charlotte, and then Mrs. Oh, what dreadful pain it is! Such agony, please, sir!"
And here Noah writhed and twisted his body into an extensive variety of eel-like positions, thereby giving Mr. Bumble to understand that, from the violent and sanguinary onset of Oliver Twist, he had sustained severe internal injury and damage, from which he was at the moment suffering the acutest torture. When Noah saw that the intelligence he communicated perfectly paralysed Mr. Bumble, he imparted additional effect thereunto by bewailing his dreadful wounds 10 times louder than before. And when he observed a gentleman in a white waistcoat crossing the yard, he was more tragic in his lamentations than ever, rightly conceiving it highly expedient to attract the notice and rouse the indignation of the gentleman aforesaid. The gentleman's notice was very soon attracted, for he had not walked 3 paces when he turned angrily round and inquired what that young cur was howling for, and why Mr. Bumble did not favour him with something which would render the series of vocular exclamations so designated an involuntary process.
"It's a poor boy from the free school, sir," replied Mr. Bumble, "who has been nearly murdered, all but murdered, sir, by young Twist."
"By Jove!" exclaimed the gentleman in the white waistcoat, stopping short.
"I knew it. I felt a strange presentiment from the very first that that audacious young savage would come to be hung. He has likewise attempted, sir, to murder the female servant,"
said Mr. Bumble, with a face of ashy paleness.
"And his missus," interposed Mr. Claypole.
"And his master, too, I think you said, Noah,"
added Mr. Bumble.
"No, he's out, or he would have murdered him," replied Noah. "He said he wanted to."
"Ah, said he wanted to, did he, my boy?"
inquired the gentleman in the white waistcoat.
Yes, sir," replied Noah. "And please, sir, missus wants to know whether Mr. Bumble can spare time to step up there directly and flog him, 'cause master's out."
"Certainly, my boy. Certainly,"
said the gentleman in the white waistcoat, smiling benignly and patting Noah's head, which was about 3 inches higher than his own.
"You're a good boy, a very good boy. Here's a penny for you. Bumble, just step up to Sowerberry's with your cane and see what's best to be done. Don't spare him, Bumble." "No, I will not, sir," replied the beadle,
adjusting the wax end, which was twisted round the bottom of his cane, for purposes of parochial flagellation.
"Tell Sowerberry not to spare him either. They'll never do anything with him without stripes and bruises,"
said the gentleman in the white waistcoat.
"I'll take care, sir,"
replied the beadle. And the cocked hat and cane having been by this time adjusted to their owner's satisfaction, Mr. Bumble and Noah Claypole betook themselves with all speed to the undertaker's shop. Here the position of affairs had not at all improved. Sowerberry had not yet returned, and Oliver continued to kick with undiminished vigour at the cellar door. The accounts of his ferocity, as related by Mrs. Sowerberry and Charlotte, were of so startling a nature that Mr. Bumble judged it prudent to parley before opening the door. With this view, he gave a kick at the outside by way of prelude, and then, applying his mouth to the keyhole, said in a deep and impressive tone,
"Oliver!"
"Come, you let me out!"
replied Oliver from the inside.
"Do you know this here voice, Oliver?"
said Mr. Bumble.
"Yes!"
replied Oliver.
"Ain't you afraid of it, sir? Ain't you a-trembling while I speak, sir?"
said Mr. Bumble.
"No!"
replied Oliver boldly. An answer so different from the one he had expected to elicit, and was in the habit of receiving, staggered Mr. Bumble not a little. He stepped back from the keyhole, drew himself up to his full height, and looked from one to another of the three bystanders in mute astonishment.
"Oh, you know, Mr. Bumble, he must be mad," said Mrs. Sowerberry. "No boy in half his senses could venture to speak so to you."
"It's not madness, ma'am,"
replied Mr. Bumble, after a few moments of deep meditation.
"It's meat."
"What?"
exclaimed Mrs. Sowerberry.
"Meat, ma'am. Meat,"
replied Bumble with stern emphasis.
"You've overfed him, ma'am. You've raised a artificial soul and spirit in him, ma'am, unbecoming a person of his condition. As the board, Mrs. Sowerberry, who are practical philosophers, will tell you. What have paupers to do with soul or spirit? It's quite enough that we let them have live bodies. If you had kept the boy on gruel, ma'am, this would never have happened."
"Dear, dear!"
ejaculated Mrs. Sowerberry, piously raising her eyes to the kitchen ceiling. "This comes of being liberal." The liberality of Mrs. Sowerberry to Oliver had consisted in a profuse bestowal upon him of all the dirty odds and ends which nobody else would eat. So there was a great deal of meekness and self-devotion in her voluntarily remaining under Mr. Bumble's heavy accusation, of which, to do her justice, she was wholly innocent in thought, word, or deed.
"Ah,"
said Mr. Bumble, when the lady brought her eyes down to earth again,
"the only thing that can be done now, that I know of, is to leave him in the cellar for a day or so, till he's a little starved down, and then to take him out and keep him on gruel all through his apprenticeship. He comes of a bad family. Excitable natures, Mrs. Sowerberry. Both the nurse and doctor said that that mother of his made her way here against difficulties and pain that would have killed any well-disposed woman weeks before."
At this point of Mr. Bumble's discourse, Oliver, just hearing enough to know that some new allusion was being made to his mother, recommenced kicking with a violence that rendered every other sound inaudible. Sowerberry returned at this juncture. Oliver's offence having been explained to him, with such exaggerations as the ladies thought best calculated to rouse his ire, he unlocked the cellar door in a twinkling and dragged his rebellious apprentice out by the collar. Oliver's clothes had been torn in the beating he had received. His face was bruised and scratched, and his hair scattered over his forehead. The angry flush had not disappeared, however, and when he was pulled out of his prison, he scowled boldly on Noah and looked quite undismayed.
"Now, you're a nice young fellow, ain't you?"
said Sowerberry, giving Oliver a shake and a box on the ear.
"He called my mother names," replied Oliver. "Well, and what if he did, you little ungrateful wretch?" said Mrs. Sowerberry. "She deserved what he said, and worse." "She didn't," said Oliver. "She did," said Mrs. Sowerberry. "It's a lie," said Oliver.
Mrs. Sowerberry burst into a flood of tears. This flood of tears left Mr. Sowerberry no alternative. If he had hesitated for one instant to punish Oliver most severely, it must be quite clear to every experienced reader that he would have been, according to all precedents in disputes of matrimony established, a brute, an unnatural husband, an insulting creature, a base imitation of a man, and various other agreeable characters too numerous for recital within the limits of this chapter. To do him justice, he was, as far as his power went, it was not very extensive, kindly disposed towards the boy, perhaps because it was his interest to be so, perhaps because his wife disliked him. The flood of tears, however, left him no resource, so he at once gave him a drubbing which satisfied even Mrs. Sowerberry herself, and rendered Mr. Bumble's subsequent application of the parochial cane rather unnecessary. For the rest of the day he was shut up in the back kitchen in company with a pump and a slice of bread. And at night, Mrs. Sowerberry, after making various remarks outside the door, by no means complimentary to the memory of his mother, looked into the room and, amidst the jeers and pointings of Noah and Charlotte, ordered him upstairs to his dismal bed. It was not until he was left alone in the silence and stillness of the gloomy workshop of the undertaker that Oliver gave way to the feelings which the day's treatment may be supposed likely to have awakened in a mere child. He had listened to their taunts with a look of contempt. He had borne the lash without a cry,
for he felt that pride swelling in his heart which would have kept down a shriek to the last, though they had roasted him alive. But now, when there were none to see or hear him, he fell upon his knees on the floor, and hiding his face in his hands, wept such tears as, God send for the credit of our nature, few so young may ever have cause to pour out before him. For a long time Oliver remained motionless in this attitude. The candle was burning low in the socket when he rose to his feet. Having gazed cautiously round him and listened intently, he gently undid the fastenings of the door and looked abroad. It was a cold, dark night. The stars seemed to the boy's eyes farther from the earth than he had ever seen them before. There was no wind, and the sombre shadows thrown by the trees upon the ground looked sepulchral and death-like from being so still. He softly reclosed the door. Having availed himself of the expiring light of the candle to tie up in a handkerchief the few articles of wearing apparel he had, sat himself down upon a bench to wait for morning. With the first ray of light that struggled through the crevices in the shutters, Oliver arose and again unbarred the door. One timid look around, one moment's pause of hesitation, he had closed it behind him and was in the open street. He looked to the right and to the left, uncertain whither to fly. He remembered to have seen the wagons as they went out, toiling up the hill. He took the same route, and arriving at a footpath across the fields, which he knew after some distance led out again into the road, struck into it and walked quickly on. Along this same footpath, Oliver well remembered he had trotted beside Mr. Bumble when he first carried him to the workhouse from the farm. His way lay directly in front of the cottage. His heart beat quickly when he bethought himself of this, and he half resolved to turn back. He had come a long way, though, and should lose a great deal of time by doing so. Besides, it was so early that there was very little fear of his being seen. So he walked on. He reached the house. There was no appearance of its inmates stirring at that early hour. Oliver stopped and peeped into the garden. A child was weeding one of the little beds. As he stopped, he raised his pale face and disclosed the features of one of his former companions. Oliver felt glad to see him before he went, for though younger than himself, he had been his little friend and playmate. They had been beaten and starved and shut up together many and many a time. "Hush, Dick," said Oliver, as the boy ran to the gate and thrust his thin arm between the rails to greet him. "Is anyone up?"
"Nobody but me," replied the child.
"You mustn't say you saw me, Dick," said Oliver. "I am running away. They beat and ill-use me, Dick, and I am going to seek my fortune some long way off. I don't know where. How pale you are."
"I heard the doctor tell them I was dying,"
replied the child, with a faint smile.
"I am very glad to see you, dear. But don't stop. Don't stop."
"Yes, yes, I will, to say goodbye to you," replied Oliver. "I shall see you again, Dick. I know I shall. You will be well and happy."
"I hope so," replied the child. "After I am dead, but not before. I know the doctor must be right, Oliver, because I dream so much of heaven and angels and kind faces that I never see when I am awake. Kiss me,"
said the child, climbing up the low gate and flinging his little arms round Oliver's neck.
"Goodbye, dear. God bless you."
The blessing was from a young child's lips, but it was the first that Oliver had ever heard invoked upon his head. And through the struggles and sufferings and troubles and changes of his afterlife, he never once forgot it. Chapter 8. Oliver walks to London. He encounters on the road a strange sort of young gentleman. Oliver reached the stile at which the bypath terminated, and once more gained the high road. It was 8 o'clock now.
Though he was nearly 5 miles away from the town, he ran and hid behind the hedges by turns till noon, fearing that he might be pursued and overtaken. Then he sat down to rest by the side of the milestone and began to think for the first time where he had better go and try to live. The stone by which he was seated bore, in large characters, an intimation that it was just 70 miles from that spot to London. The name awakened a new train of ideas in the boy's mind.